This episode of Outlines contains descriptions of a crime which some people may find distressing. So, as always, listener discretion is advised. This is the second part of my look into the murder of David Watkins. And if you haven't listened to the first part already, then I suggest you do so, because it may not make much sense otherwise. I want to begin today by giving you a little background into the man accused of the crime, Andrew Everson. There isn't always a lot of information available on suspects in a case like this, even those with a criminal past. Yet with Andrew, this is far from true. In the research phase of episodes, I like to perform a number of searches relating to all the people involved in the cases I'm writing about. And what shocked me with Andrew is just how far back you can find reports of his crimes and misadventures. He himself had something of a difficult upbringing. He came from a home in which his father had lost contact with him as a child, and his mother, who had, by all accounts, suffered greatly following the divorce, appears to have taken that out on her children. Andrew was taken into care at some point during his childhood, and throughout his youth he apparently suffered physical, psychological, and sexual abuse. It was reported later that he was first arrested in 1976, at just 12 years old, and by February of 1982 he was, from what I could discover, first mentioned in the papers, alongside his brother. The two, it was claimed, were responsible for having stolen a number of Ford Capris in Bracknell and Reading. Andrew admitted the charge, saying that he had taken three Capris, as well as burgling White's garage in Bracknell, where he had stolen five sets of car keys. Andrew asked that, as well as these, the court also took 15 further offences of theft and taking vehicles without consent into account. The article told of how Andrew, who was committed to Reading Crown Court for sentencing, was already in possession of a number of previous convictions for theft, burglary, and a host of what were described as similar offences. He had served a term in Borstal in 1980, and a few days prior to his 1982 court appearance, had also appeared in London, where he was sentenced to 6 months in prison, again for the same kind of crime. Andrew's story is one which tells a sadly all too familiar tale of a child let down by the systems put in place to protect them. One who easily became caught up in a learned lifestyle of crime, imprisonment, and reoffending, and over a period of time, those crimes became worse and worse, until, finally, many years after due, he would be imprisoned for murder. I'm Jess Carter, and this is a Patreon-exclusive episode of the Outlines podcast. Continuing in a linear fashion through the news articles available, in October of 1982, 17-year-old Andrew Everson again appeared in court, this time with two other youths of the same age. The three teenagers all admitted to having committed burglaries in a couple of garages in Berkshire. Andrew and a lad named Roger Rochester both pled guilty to burglary at Cheveley Motors, and to stealing property worth £1,218.36 in September of that year. They also admitted to having robbed Emma Green Garage in Reading, alongside Andrew Davies, where they had stolen a number of car keys. As well as these offences, Andrew Everson also pleaded guilty to having taken an Alfa Romeo car from Southampton without the consent of the owner, and having driven it while disqualified, and without being in possession of insurance. Following this, there is a gap of a little over a year before Everson was again reported on in the papers. This time, it was late November of 1983, and the Reading Evening Post told of how Andrew Everson and a man named Geoffrey Olive together were charged with three separate burglaries, the combined total of which was a little over £3,000. As well as this, Olive was charged with having taken and driven away a Morris Ital. Everson, for his part, took a Porsche. Reading through these early articles, you begin to see a pattern emerge in Everson's actions, one which was touched upon in his 1994 trial. He obviously had an eye for expensive things, and doesn't seem to have held down a proper job, instead relying upon thievery to fund his lifestyle. This is a pattern of behaviour which seems to have persisted up until 1994, by which time he was not only involved in stealing, but also the dealing of drugs. You'd expect that the 94 murder trial might have spurred him on to lay low for a while, and following it, he did move out of Berkshire, well, as far as the village of Sonning Common in South Oxfordshire, which is only about 6 miles from Reading. And despite this, he could not seem to kick the criminal aspects of his life. In late May of 1995, he was caught twice in 2 days by well-off homeowners who had surprised him as he attempted to burgle their houses. His plan was to select large homes in well-to-do villages and then to break in during the day while the residents were at work. His first attempted robbery was of a house in the village of Eversley, not too far south of Reading. Unfortunately for Andrew, the resident returned home and, as he fled the scene, followed him in his car. As the homeowner attempted to confront Everson, he pulled a knife, causing his victim to flee in fear. On the second occasion, he broke into the home of a woman in Beech Lane in Woodcote. He was in the kitchen, again in the middle of the day, when she returned home to discover a large number of valuables stacked next to her front door. Everson himself had run out of the back when he'd heard her come in, and when she chased him, he again pulled a knife, telling her, "Get away, or you'll get some of this." Thankfully, police were able to trace his car number plate, and he was soon arrested. While he did admit the burglary, Andrew denied having been in possession of a knife, saying that he was carrying a screwdriver and a chisel on both days, and that his victims must have mistaken them for a blade. Despite the pleas of Everson's then-girlfriend, Hazel, who insisted to the court that if he were to avoid jail, she could influence him with love, Andrew found himself being sentenced to 4 years for aggravated burglary. Defending him, Michael Osilk told the court that Everson had just spent 13 months in jail for a crime he did not commit, and on release, he found himself with no friends or family for support. While the courts agreed that Everson's past made for sad reading, it was still felt that only a jail term was the appropriate outcome. You might imagine that this time the prison sentence would have been enough to dissuade Everson from criminal activity. But by early May of 1999, he was again back in court. This time, he had admitted to being in possession of ammunition and drugs and having committed a burglary. He was responsible for three separate charges of handling stolen goods, one of burglary, as well as two counts of possessing Class B drugs, and illegally having two 12-gauge shotgun cartridges, which were found in a Ford Fiesta that he had been using on November the 28th, 1998. The judge, who told Everson that his criminal record was appalling, said, "Your life of crime started at the age of 12. In the past, you have been given chances, but they've made no difference to the pattern of your crimes." He was sentenced to 2 years in prison. While this is the last report of wrongdoing I can find before his second arrest in relation to the murder of David Watkins, this may not speak to Andrews having changed his behaviour following his 99 conviction. I don't know for sure, but it coincides nicely with the period of journalism which has been caught somewhere between the analogue and digital archival of stories. From the early until the mid-2000s, or a little later, there isn't much in the way of consistently available online local news, and so it's more than possible that he committed crimes throughout this period, and that they just aren't accessible in a digitised form. As I alluded to in the first part of this case, between the 1994 trial and Andrew's rearrest in the mid-2010s, one major change to the law had occurred which would make it possible to retry his case. This was the 2003 amendments to the Double Jeopardy Law, which, prior to then, had meant that a person who had been acquitted or convicted of an offence could not be retried for the same crime. In 2003, though, that all changed, and in Part 10 of the Criminal Justice Act, the law was reformed to allow a retrial in the case of serious offences where what is described as new and compelling evidence had come to light. So, what exactly did this mean in the case of Andrew Everson? It's obvious that, despite his acquittal, the police had never quite managed to disregard him fully as a suspect. As always, an unsolved murder case remains technically open, even after it becomes what we would refer to as cold. So, in 2013, following a review of David's murder, Thames Valley Police appear to have identified some key factors in the case, which could be investigated again with more modern forensic techniques. It was then that a laboratory called Contact Traces, who specialised in fibre examinations, were contacted, and they were asked to review the relevant existing evidence in regards to David Watkins' murder, as well as conducting a more general review of the information to assess whether any new lines of inquiry could be used by the investigation team. Most of the facts pertaining to fibre analysis that you're going to hear come from a paper by a man named Tin and Coyle, which was published in December 2020 in the journal Forensic Science International Reports. Tiernan was one of those at Contact Traces who was tasked with re-evaluating the evidence, and his account of that process, which I'll link below, contains a much more thorough rundown of the various factors considered than I can include here, so if you're interested, it's well worth reading. At this point, you'll have to excuse any information repeated between this and the first part of these episodes, but I think it's important to have everything laid out as it was at the time. The beginning of Tiernan's paper states that in 1993, the police's case against Andrew Everson was largely circumstantial and included what he describes as an alleged confession. The only physical evidence available was from fibre examinations conducted by the Forensic Science Service. The evidence itself consisted of 39 fibres from car seat material that established a link between Andrew Everson's car at the time, a Peugeot 309 GTI, and the clothing worn by David Watkins at the moment of his murder. The forensic strategy, as it was in February of 1993, is described by Tiernan as having been difficult to decipher, although he says that it appears to have been centred around white fluff, which had been found on David's jeans, and of which I can find very little reference. More generally, though, they wished to examine his clothing for any other fibres, as well as those of Andrew Everson's taken at his arrest, and any other outer clothing he possessed, and items from his Peugeot. Slides and tapings were taken from the seats of Everson's car, alongside the fibres recovered from David Watkins' clothing. Two other vehicles were also scoured for evidence. These were a Ford Transit, probably the van that David Watkins had rented that evening, and a Peugeot of a different model to Andrew's. This Peugeot's seats were of a different fibre type and colour. It appears as if the work carried out at the time to identify the sources or source of the fibres on David's clothing was extensive and thorough. And again, there is much more information available on the process in Tiernan Coyle's paper. To link the 39 fibres found on David's clothing with Andrew Everson's car, it was first necessary to rule out any other Peugeots from which the fibres may also have come. Everson's car seats were made from a mix of red nylon, black nylon, and polyester fibres, and on David's jacket and jeans were 28 separate samples, which are described as microscopically matching those from the car seats in the 309 GTI. There were 17 red nylon, 10 black nylon, and 1 polyester fibre. It was easy enough to rule out David Watkins' car, strangely also a Peugeot, because his seats were made from blue and colourless acrylic fibres, very different to those found. The other Peugeot, however, was a 205 GTI, belonging to a man who the paper refers to as Mr. F. This was also examined, and the fibres found to be a match. However, David had not been in this car since November of 1992, and the expert deemed that, in their opinion, it was extremely unlikely that so many fibres would remain on his clothing for this period of time. While one or two may have done, it was, the expert said, inconceivable that they all did. The expert concluded that the car seat material in question was only used in the manufacture of two specific car models, the Peugeot 205 and 309 GTIs. There would, the expert said, have been at least 5,755 cars exported to the UK with identical seating, though given that there were, at the time, 23.6 million cars registered in the UK, they stated that the presence of fibres that could have come from Quartet fabric on Watkins' clothing is therefore a highly significant finding, and as I have stated previously, provides strong evidence to indicate that David Watkins had recently sat in Andrew Everson's car. Interestingly, though, Tiernan Coyle notes that by the time of the trial, the emphasis on this conclusion had been dramatically decreased from there being strong evidence to suggest that this had been the case, down to consistent with. Interestingly, it is suggested that at the initial trial, this downgrade, alongside the evidence of the friend of David's who owned the 205 GTI, may have influenced the way in which the jury saw the importance of this fibre evidence. Later in his paper, Tiernan Coyle goes on to identify a number of times in which the laboratory notes from 1993 contradict statements made at the trial. An example is that apparently the notes categorically stated that the polyester fibres from Mr. F's 205 GTI were different from those from Andrew Everson's car, although at trial, he quotes that it was said that the sample was found to be made up of red and black nylon flock fibres and black polyester fibres. These microscopically matched the constituent fibres in the car seats of the Peugeot 309 GTI. Tin and Coyle states that this is a crucial difference, and that if the fibres matched Everson's car, but not Mr. F's, then the 1993 interpretation of these findings is incorrect. He says, if so, the jury at the original trial had been denied the opportunity to infer from the fibre evidence that it was more likely that the flock fibres arose from Andrew Everson's car than Mr. F's car, because the presence of the pigmented fibres and the flock fibres made it more likely that they transferred together from contact with the interior of Andrew Everson's car, rather than some combination of events involving Mr. F's vehicle a month earlier. The conclusions drawn by contact traces was that, while the work carried out in 1993 was performed to the highest standard available at the time, by 2013 there was a need to reassess the information with more modern techniques. I won't list the multitudes of new angles that the company proposed to be worth looking into, but suffice to say, there was plenty which could be seen as requiring reanalysis, and that would benefit from modern and more sensitive forensic testing. It is obvious that by this point, the police's intent was either to rule out Andrew Everson completely, or to establish enough new information to seek a retrial for David's murder. But this was not to be a quick process. In 2015, around 2 years from when the company Contact Traces were first asked to look into the fibre analysis, Andrew Everson was eventually re-interviewed by Thames Valley Police and subsequently charged again with the murder of David Watkins. Despite the fact that he was still denying the killing, several key points in his statement had changed from his initial 1993 interviews. Most notably, he now admitted to having sold David cannabis on a number of previous occasions, including the night of his murder. When pressed as to why he had omitted this detail originally, he claimed that it was because he did not want the police to know he was a drug dealer, which feels a little moot considering that it doesn't appear that the police had a moment's doubt as to his profession. His other notable confession was that again, despite what he said previously, he had purchased a shotgun, but he claimed to have gotten rid of it a short while later. While Andrew's rearrest may have felt like real progress, it would still take some time, until July 2018 to be precise, before permission was granted to quash Everson's previous acquittal. It was only then that it was agreed that police had presented the court with enough new and compelling evidence to finally recharge him with David Watkins' murder. The trial opened in the early months of 2019. Evidence was heard from a man named Mr. Aird, who claimed that he had introduced David and Andrew in September of 1992, and that, on what seems to have been a separate occasion, he had seen Everson and another man in a car. In the same car, he said, were bags containing a large quantity of cannabis, as well as what appeared to him to be a shotgun. This information appears to tally with the 1993 police report, in which it was claimed that Everson and David Watkins first met through an acquaintance of Everson's, whom he had known since a prison stint in 1988. The court heard that as late as November of 1992, Everson had purchased a double-barreled shotgun from a woman named Mrs. McCarthy. Two more friends also gave evidence which placed Andrew Everson in the possession of a shotgun in the weeks leading up to the murder. These were a Mr. Bayliss, who claimed he had been shown the weapon by Everson in late 1992, and a Mr. Pilbeam, who established that on the 10th of January 1993, 4 days before David's murder, and a date which was confirmed via a TV programme he had been watching, that Everson had shown him a shotgun and asked him to get cartridges for it. Pilbeam claimed that he had refused to do so. Bolstering these eyewitness accounts, which corroborated the claims that Everson had indeed owned a shotgun at around the time of the murder, the court also heard about a couple, but not all of his previous convictions. One appears to have been the late 90s offence in which he was found in possession of a shotgun cartridges. The other, which I couldn't find any reported details on, was from 1989, almost 10 years earlier, and it established a long-running affinity between Everson and shotguns. While these previous convictions were to be taken into account by the jury, the judge at the time was keen to point out that they must not be the deciding factor when determining guilt. Unfortunately, there is no one clear and concise account of the full trial proceedings, and there are certain facts pertaining to the new trial which have been much easier for me to establish than others. Most of them stem from information available online involving a later court appeal. Sadly, this means that it's difficult to know how much emphasis was placed on evidence such as the reanalysed fibre work. What we do know, though, is that the case against Andrew Everson was compelling enough that on the 3rd of April 2019, he was finally convicted of the murder of David Watkins and sentenced to life imprisonment, with a minimum of 27 years, minus the 895 days he'd already spent remanded in custody or on bail. He was 54 years old at the time, and the conviction means that he's likely to see out the majority of the remainder of his life in prison. Speaking after the case was concluded, David's partner, Susan, standing alongside their now grown-up sons, Stephen and James, spoke of the family's pain at having to go through the retrial so many years after the murder had occurred. Susan said, "When police came round to tell me that David had been killed, it was total disbelief. My dad once said to me, 'You have to deal with what you can't change.' So that is exactly what I did. I couldn't bring David back, so I coped by adopting a matter-of-fact attitude. I hardened emotionally in order to make life normal again and move on. I had to keep it together for the sake of my very young children." Susan described the retrial as like opening Pandora's box, going on to say, "We had to relive the very worst period of our lives for a second time. But this time, my sons were old enough to understand the harrowing details." She finished her statement by thanking the police. And finally, in a quote which I feel could be no more fitting for the end of an episode such as this, she said, "Everson has robbed me of growing old with the man I loved. He has robbed my children of their father. But, in spite of everything, our family has stayed strong, and my David's legacy lives on through my boys, who have grown up to be amazing men. Murder creates more victims than the person who is killed. It changes lives and devastates families." This episode of Outlines was researched, written, performed and produced by Jess Carter. The music was composed by Elias Hardy.